the government comes out and they can change their mind, and they change it sometimes in your favor when zoning gets changed, and sometimes it's not in your favor.
Going back when you were accumulating properties at 21, at 24, you left your full-time job. What were you doing?
I decided to make the side gig the main gig. And so
Ravi Sharma is the founder of award-winning Search Property and built a $15 million property portfolio by age 32.
He also shares his expertise on real estate and investing through his YouTube channel, Personal Finance with Ravi Sharma, and the More Than Money podcast.
I don't think property prices continue going up just in a straight line. It'd be silly. But that line going up straight to the right is only because we have the...
With the areas you're looking into, what sort of DD and what risks are you finding in different areas?
We're looking at...
What's the game plan? How does someone get from 0 to 10 in a perfect world?
So I think there's a couple of things. One, you've got to buy the right.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Unemployable Podcast. Today, we have a special guest that has flown all the way here from Sydney just to be on the Unemployable Podcast. His name is Ravi Sharma. He's a property investor turned content creator, and now he's a personal finance expert. And we're going to bring so much fire in this podcast so you guys can learn everything about wealth creation. Ravi, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on, boys.
It was good. We've been talking off camera a little bit about different things, and I can't wait to unpack this one because there's so much. You've got so much value to bring, and your story is incredible as well. So I want to say thank you to Shannon and Carson for being on pod with us as usual.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks for having us as always.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Look forward to it. Be good.
Shannon and Carson are very, very busy boys with their land development business. It's great to have them here adding value all the time and showing up for all of us here and the guests listening, so much value. So at 21, you started investing in property. By 24, you left your full-time job, which was working at Mars, like literally Mars bars. And in 2020, you decided, you know what, I'm going to create a YouTube channel. And that YouTube channel is called Personal Finance with Ravi Sharma. And fast forward 5 years, you now have 100,000 followers, and you're a trusted voice in the personal finance space on YouTube in this country. First off, I just want to say well done. We all know how hard it is growing a YouTube channel. We started 18 months ago, and here we are with, you know, cracking on to maybe 21,000 subscribers. And we know that how difficult that is, showing up every week and just putting out content and trying to get good guests on. And our team reached out to you, and I started doing some research on you. I'm like, yeah, let's definitely get Ravi on. I think he'd be great for the audience. You also own 19 properties yourself, which is quite extraordinary, right? Because majority of people are just trying to get into the market now and just trying to buy half of one, you know. So that's amazing. But I guess let's take it back a little bit so people get to know a little bit more about you. And then we really want to unpack, you know, the finance side. I really want to dig into the property side and what you see is happening in the property market and how people can get into the property market and what strategies you're seeing some of your clients doing, because you also have a large buyer's agency called Search Property, which helps Australians buy property across the country in multiple states. So we'll dig into that as well a little bit. I wanted to hear off camera, we were talking, and you do a fair bit in the crypto world as well. So we'll touch base on that a little bit. And I know Shannon and Carson got some questions and topics they want to dig into. So I guess let's take it back to, you making Mars bars and how that all started and how did you go from, you know, working in a Mars bar factory, I'm assuming, to buying a property?
Well, let's clear that up. I wasn't making Mars bars. That would taste terrible if I did that. I remember going down to Ballarat where they had the actual, you know, warehouse was the factory. It was the chocolate factory. And I didn't believe that they actually had a chocolate factory here in Australia. And boy, was I surprised. So that was amazing. I was there for almost 2 years, 3 years, something like that. And put on a bit of weight, which is nice. For me, I did everything you traditionally get told to do. You know, I've come from an Indian background. I was born here. So parents were like, look, you have to go to school. You have to go to uni. and then find a full-time job. So I did exactly that. I didn't really pay much attention at school. I realized that it was more a game of memorizing things rather than actually, you know, critical thinking. And so did uni, did quite well. But as soon as I started uni, I realized that, you know, education alone is not going to get me out, because I saw people that were graduating and they were finding it hard to find a job. So I started doing internships for free. And that first unpaid internship, boy, I should have paid more attention, but it was like this concept. I was sat with a couple of people, the Europeans, and they were like, what you need to learn is SEO. And I was like, what's that? And I was like, I thought marketing was like brand and, you know, all of this stuff. And he's like, no, this is it. And then like digital marketing is the next big thing. And I got bored and didn't pay attention, but I should have. And so yeah, did uni, went through and just worked in retail jobs. I was working like pretty much 40 hours a week while I was doing uni full time. And then graduated, got Mars Chocolate, again, was working there, and realized that there's probably a better thing to do here, because I had a chat with my manager and she goes, hey, so, you know, if you do this for 10 years, I started as a grad like you. And if I do this for 10 years, you do it for 10 years, you'll end up where I am. And she had just broken up with her long-term partner because she was prioritizing work. She was traveling a lot and, you know, you could see that she was, you know, stressed. I was like, why the hell would I want that in 10 years time? So I realized that that flicked the switch. I need to get out. And the only way I knew how was you got to invest into assets. And everyone knew about real estate. And I went to this one conference. It was run by some old dude and it was in an RSL club. And my brother took me and he's like, man, let's just go. And my brother's like 2 years older than me. And he said, oh, listen to this guy. Maybe he'll change our minds. And it was buy 10 properties in 10 years and retire. I was like, well, I'd prefer that. Yeah. And in 10 years, I'd be retired. I'm done. So that's basically where the switch flicked for me. And it was like, okay, I need to escape this and then ultimately find stuff I'm passionate about, because I want to do that for the rest of my life and maybe just build a machine with real estate and then I'm good.
You know, like I love like the Indian cultures and the Chinese cultures, they're big on education, right? And they're like, okay, we're going to immigrate to the country. You have to do well at high school. You got to go to university. You got to get a degree and be in the corporate world, you know? And then like
doctor.
The old school Europeans are like, okay, you're now going to be a builder. You learn how to do concrete, you know? Like it's like total opposite. And I think moving forward now, you know, those university degrees are going to be just as good as the paper they're written on, I think, moving forward, right? Like now we're talking about building networks. Now we're talking about how to actually manufacture equity and entrepreneurship and business. And now with the whole AI scene that's coming in and the crypto world, there's so much different opportunities now that are coming for people to make money. I know so many people that don't have any education. When I say any education, they've got high school education, but that don't have these university degrees, that are just doing so well, right? Like living life on their own terms and loving every minute of it, you know? So how did you, I guess, get into that first property? Because this is a thing that we always see it in the comments going, yeah, all good. You bought your first property, you know, at 21, which was, you know, 12 years ago. Cause he told us how old you are off camera. If you don't, hopefully you don't mind me, letting, everybody know how old you are.
No, it's late,
but you got a baby face anyway. So, because the challenge right now is like, how do I buy an average property? But like we said, off camera, you were in Sydney. You couldn't afford in Sydney. So you had to think outside of the box. And there's still opportunities now in a lot of other cities, in a lot of other towns across Australia, where people can still afford to buy a place. And people get confused when they say, I want to buy a property. Straight away, they want to buy the property that they want to live in. Mm-hmm. And where do they want to live? They want to live in the CBDs. They want to live by the beach. And then straight away, it's like, oh, I can't afford to buy a property. Forget about it. So take us back to that time where you thought outside the box.
Yeah. So born, brought up in Sydney. So everyone talks about Sydney, best property, you know, it's blue chip property. This is all you need. And I realized I've got a decision. I can either purchase something where, you know, I get the first homeowner grants, which got sold like it's the absolute dream, and I could buy an apartment in Sydney, or I could use a similar amount, probably less than that, and I could go regional. And what I realized was I could pretty much purchase two properties regionally versus the one apartment in Sydney. And so I thought, if I can go buy those properties and they pretty much only cost me like maybe $100 out of my pocket, that's a lot more sustainable than me taking up this mortgage for an apartment, which looks exactly the same as like the 10 others in the same block or 100 others that are in the same block. So I was like, okay, maybe I should make that decision. And when everyone goes right, you go left. And I remember having the conversation with my friends at the time. And I said, hey, I just bought a property. And they said, where? And I said, oh, it's in this suburb. And it was in like regional New South Wales. And they go, why would you buy there? Like, I thought you'd buy in Sydney. That's a dumb move. And at that point, I realized that we're now going down different paths. So I don't talk to anyone.
Yeah.
It didn't last too long.
No.
Which is really funny because, like, you know, when I started the buyer's agency, 10 years later, one of those guys had never bought a property and he actually came and used the buyer's agency service. And he's like, oh, you know, I've seen you grow and I've been following you on YouTube. And yeah, I think you got the right attitude.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think your dumb move's not so dumb anymore. And I might be the dummy.
But just to frame it up, like, I was very fortunate. You know, my parents, although they didn't, you know, earn a lot, they owned their own home. They had a mortgage, obviously.
Yep.
But I have that, you know, ethnic background, which is, hey, you know, they always think about the future generation. And so some of the values that they passed on to me was, okay, I've always got to be thinking forward. So forward thinking, how do I set my future generations up? And so as a result, they said, look, if you're going to spend your money on dumb shit, then you start paying board or you move out. But if you want to invest your money, you don't have to pay any rent. And I understand people listening and go, okay, that's a really unique situation to be in. But there's a lot of people that make the choice to move out from home actively, which I think now more than ever is probably going the other way. Yeah. And it's staying at home for as long as possible, because that's probably going to be your biggest leg up. And you guys all know, like, that's the time where you've got the least amount of expenses. As soon as you moved out, you're like, oh, I've got electricity bill. I didn't even know I had to pay that.
Honestly, like, we came here to Australia at 23. I lived at home, right? I come from a European background family, very similar values in culture, right? And like, literally, my mom did everything for me, you know, like, I literally did nothing and I had the life, right? To the point where, you know, my clothes are ironed, they're put away, they're folded, like, just, and we take that for granted, right? Because we moved here when we were 23, that was in 2007. So very long time ago. And in my opinion, you know, the money that you can earn versus what rent was versus what food was a lot more attainable, than it is today. Cause today, you know, the problem is people aren't leaving home, right? They're trying to stay home as long as possible. And when they do leave home, they go, holy shit, this is expensive. And I know so many people that then go and move back to save money. But the issue when you move back home to save money is you still need the discipline. And this is what most people don't have, is the discipline. Because I know a lot of people that move home to save money, and 5 years later, they save no money and they're still living at home, but they've been on the European holiday and they've got the new car. And that's the discipline that comes in. And what your parents would have educated you in, saying, hey, if you want to stay here, right, you need to save money, you need to invest, and you're not going to, you know, go stupid, because if you are, you're not going to be in that house. And that discipline goes a long way.
Oh, definitely. And you see it now, like you mentioned earlier, university degree is not really worth it now. I think with the people we employ across like 80 people, there's probably less than 20% of people that actually have a degree. And when I get sent CVs and we're looking through it, I don't even pay attention to that, because that to me, I don't, there's no value there.
Neither do I.
And for someone who's gone through that entire system, you realize that it's actually not what it's supposed to be. Like the way it's so outdated. And so in the real world, especially when you're talking about like things like real estate, it's a whole different beast on its own.
Yeah.
But right now, if people are going, okay, I can eat shit for the next 5 to 10 years and set myself up, that's the move you got to make. But I've sort of gone on record, you know, and talking about it on YouTube, where I was like, I still went on holidays. I still managed to do all those things, but I did the property first.
Yeah.
And so all you need to do is you can have best of all worlds. You know, traveling at 23 is not that different at 27.
Yeah.
Now, 23 compared to 40, very different.
Yep.
And so what I'm saying is, okay, you don't need to go out there and buy 10, 15, 20 properties. It's okay, let's get started. Let's get those investing muscles working. Then you go, okay, I've now understood the value of something like this. The machine's growing in the background. Let me go travel a bit. I'll come back and I'm like, okay, I'm over traveling for the next 12 months, buckle down, and the property's growing in equity. Now I can learn a bit more about, you know, because I've got skin in the game.
Correct.
I stand a little bit on the fence with a comment around having a university degree and not having a university degree. I'm very much one way. Like, I left school at grade 8.
Oh, nice.
I finished grade 8 and I left from there. But all of our consultants around us, we wouldn't be able to do what we do if we didn't have them, and all of them have university degrees.
Yeah.
What I see trained into them is they don't take risk. It's so trained into them to stay within the box that they don't take risk. Some of the guys that we work with put us to shame. Like, they would very easily do what we do, but they don't. They specialize in their field and their field only.
Yeah. And I think it's like, when I say university degree, I think of it from an entrepreneurial mindset, right?
Yeah.
I don't think of it from, like, if you want to be a doctor, if you want to be a lawyer, right? You want to be a vet, you want to be, you know, a town planner, you want to be these types of civil engineer and these types of consultants, you have no choice, right? To go and do that. But in my opinion, right, is we need those people around us. Not, imagine if this world was full of crazy guys like us.
Oh.
Right? Like, it's not meant to be like that, right? Like, we can't educate the world to say, hey, go and take risks and go and start business and buy property and do options and put down deposits and all this crazy stuff and start a business. And that's not the way the world is supposed to be. So I agree with you 110%. I think more of it from the entrepreneurial mindset, going like, if you want to go and set up a business, right, go and do accounting is an example, right? Now, you might go do an accounting course. I think accounting is probably one of the number one things that everybody should know. Because once you know 100%. That, right, you can adapt that to business, you can adapt that to personal finance. And the reality is, the reason why you got guys like Ravi Sharma, right, that has 100,000 followers on his personal finance with Ravi Sharma on YouTube, and you've got, you know, Unemployable, is because this isn't educated in school in a university degree. They're teaching us and our kids things that they're not going to really need to know too much. And that's my belief, right? But I totally agree with you. We wouldn't be able to do anything without the lawyer and the accountant and the town planner and the civil engineer and the doctor and these types of people. So if that's who you are, all good. But, you know, at the end of the day, I still don't think a lot of those people are living the life that they want to live from a financial standpoint. And they are, a lot of them, stuck in a box. And most of them are a lot smarter than any of us here probably on the table from an academic point of view, but from a financial level, different story. But at the end of the day, you can have a huge amount of financial experience, a huge amount of academic experience, but there's something that, I don't know how you teach to have the kahunas to go, right? I'm trying to be nice, right? And just in case kids are listening, we got a couple kids in the studio today. We got Carson's kids here. It's school holidays. My kid was here yesterday. He's brought his kids here today.
G-rated.
Yeah, but again, it's a decision that everybody needs to make, you know?
Yeah. Ravi, I'm keen to pick your brain, obviously, with the, when you're building that portfolio early days, you're normally going to tap out serviceability or you're going to tap out with equity. What's the secret sauce and the balance when you're talking to your clients or someone comes to you and say, hey, I'm stuck on one property. If you're starting from scratch and you can build someone out from the beginning, what's the right playbook in your eyes to build, like, for someone that actually wants to get, you know, essentially, you know, the 10 properties and maybe sell 5 at the end or just keep them and if they get cash flow positive, what's the blueprint?
There's a bit more support at the moment as well with the 5% deposits and getting into it. So
yeah, it's like we talk about how, you know, property and getting into property is so much harder now because prices are higher. But lenders, there's like 50, 60, 70 lenders now compared to everyone just had to go to the big 4 banks. Mm-hmm. And now you have deposit schemes, shared equity schemes. So it's actually a lot easier to get in. It's just that the price is going higher relative to income. So people go, oh, it's actually quite hard. And that's the excuse people are using. But one of the big things is if you can't get credit, you can't get property, right? Simple as that. So one of the things I was doing was I had a full-time job, but after hours, I decided, hey, I'm young. I like going out. So I'm going to become a nightclub promoter. And so what started off as like making $50 a week turned into $1,500 a week. And that was just what I'd do on a Friday and a Saturday night on top of what I was doing. And I think a lot of people, I'm not going to say entitled, but they're very particular about how people view them. So it's like, hey, I don't want to do that job, even though it's going to pay me a lot because of the status it, you know, it comes with. So for example, I find it really interesting. We spoke about school, so I'll stop shitting on school for in a second because I know there's kids here. But the school teacher goes on to tell you, if you don't listen in school, you're going to become a garbage man. Yeah. And then you realize the garbage man makes more than the teacher. Mm. And you're like, what? That screwed me up. And so even then, like, I used to get judged because I was DJing, I was at nightclubs, I was running nightclub events. And when I came out and said, oh, I've got all this property and this is what I do and this is the education that I can share, people were just like, no, that's not possible because I saw you DJing like last week. It's like, yeah, but that was because I know that that side income in my company, an extra 50K could allow me to borrow enough to get enough equity out and do X, Y, and Z. So now I think it's like, we live in an era where social media is huge, AI is massive. You can have a side hustle, which gets you the $10,000, $20,000. And so finance is simple. Reduce your expenses, increase your income. And so I know I'm trying to simplify things, but you've got so many options now versus back then. If you wanted a side hustle, what were you going to do?
It's not even, you can have a side hustle. You need a side hustle.
Yeah, yeah,
you,
I agree.
You have to have something going on to be able to get extra.
Mm. Yeah, that's why we, you know, started Unemployable, because people need to get an understanding on how else to make money, right? Like, you make money multiple ways, right? You guys make money in different ways. I make money in multiple ways. And people need to get a good understanding, right? That you're not going to be able to get ahead on two average incomes, and you're not going to save your way to wealth. In the Western world, you're not going to be able to do that. So people have got to, you know, look in the mirror and go, you have to make a decision, right? And the decision is, we continue to do what we're doing every day for the rest of our lives, and we're okay with the lifestyle, right? And the outcomes that we have. Or you need to make a change, right? And it starts with educating yourself and having the conviction. A lot of people get scared, right? Because they're not educated. Like, when I talk to someone like, you know, Adam, who's on the pod with us, our business partner, right? Like, the conviction he has towards Bitcoin, it's unbelievable. So the more I hang out with him, the more I get educated on it, the more papers that he sends me, white papers, and the more, you know, YouTube videos that he sends me, and people that he's talking to, the more conviction I get. And then I look at it as less risk in my mind, right? So everyone has to find what that is, right? Some people look at business as very risky. Business is so risky. Most businesses fail. That's the reality, right? But I think most businesses fail because people aren't educated properly, and it's very easy to give up. Right? People aren't educated around property. They don't, if you were to ask people that aren't in the property game, right? And say, hey, are you going to buy property? Most of them would probably say, I can't afford it. Full stop. Mm. Not I can't afford it, but I'm looking at avenues on how I can afford it. Mm. Right? And that's why we've started Unemployable as well, right? To keep educating people, going, you do need a side hustle, right? You do need something else, like Shannon just said. So going back when you were, you know, you're accumulating properties at 21, at 24, you left your full-time job. And what did you do then? Like, were you just had enough properties that you had cash flow coming in and you still had the DJ side gig? What were you doing?
I decided to make the side gig the main gig. And so went all into the, you know, entertainment business. It branched out from just nightclub promotions to DJing to hosting weddings, event planning. And so that became my life for the next couple of years. Yeah. And as a result of all of that, I realized really quickly, because I used to watch Gary Vee and he used to do the vlogging. So I said, okay, well, I want to capture all this. And I'm going to show my kid one day that he was cool at some point in his life. And I started capturing all that, learned how to edit myself, shoot, you know, oh, what sort of cameras do I get? So I was geeking out when we were looking at the camera gear and whatnot.
Yeah.
And it's like, I had to teach myself those, obviously after hours and whatnot. And then once that became my main gig, and it was, I was running a business, but it was a one person band. So I effectively bought myself a job. But I realized that that job was paying me 3x to 4x what I was going to make if I had just stuck to that corporate gig. And that's when I realized, okay, this is great. But now I found a partner and she works a full-time job. She's at the Big Four. So that means if I'm working on the weekends and she's working during the week, this is not going to be sustainable. And I love her. I want to be with her. So I started realizing, what am I really good at? What do I want to do? And so I had tried my hand at property conveyancing, which personally I found really boring. And then I realized, okay, maybe mortgage broking. So did all my education, get my licenses and whatnot. And then I realized I wanted to become a buyer's agent, not a real estate agent, because I didn't want to sell homes. I wanted to help people buy homes. And so I did all those things with the idea that 2022, 2023, I'll wrap up the entertainment business and then I'll go into the buyer's agency full time. Fortunately, we had the pandemic and the lockdowns, which meant my business went straight to zero overnight. You know, I had refunds coming through because no one's going to get married this year, or at least they're not going to have, you know, massive gigs. And I was like, well, this is the universe telling me I have no other choice.
I need to move.
Yeah, like this is it. And I'm glad I prepped the year before because it would have been shocking if it was the year after. And so at that point I said, okay, I'll turn on YouTube. I'll just create content. Let's see what happens. And fortunately here, 5 years later, we've got a company that's working well and there's offshoots of that business. And I love doing YouTube. So one of the things I say is like, you can remove everything, but I'll still create content because, you know, when you get those emails, and you guys would get it too, you get those emails, you get the DMs of people changing their lives, either they use your services or not. That is powerful because now you've gone, my passion meets something that I'm bringing value to people and it's actually making a difference in their life. Like you continue doing that for the rest of your life.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. And so your content, what would you say is, like I said, back to the kind of the blueprint, if you like. So you've got the side gig. You're making a little bit extra coin at the moment. You know, hypothetically someone's, you know, got their median, you know, wage and they got a little side gig to make an extra 20, 30, 50 grand. Now what? So you've got one or two, you know, one property potentially, and you want to build it out. What's the game plan? Like if in a perfect scenario, when you're teaching your clients, how does someone get from 0 to 10 in a perfect world?
So I think there's a couple of things. One, you've got to buy the right type of property. So obvious, like you've got to buy something that's growing, it's in a good area and whatnot. So all of that stuff's there. But then you've also got to get the right acquisition plan. So during that phase of when I was buying property, it wasn't like I was buying every couple of months. It was periods there where I didn't buy for a year or 2 years. So you let the market do its thing as well. And so now what we have is a situation where we've got so much more education, so many more lenders. So the same bank, Bank A, could give you, based on the same metrics, 200K less in terms of borrowing capacity versus someone else. So what we educate people on, or at least help clients with, is, okay, let's work back to front. So if you want to end up with 100K passive income, let's say, how do we get there? Could we buy 5 properties and hold them forever? Do we just buy 2 and try and pay them off? Like there's multiple ways to get there. And that's just going to be in line with, you know, whatever their lifestyle is and risk profile. But then you got different structures. So if you're buying under personal, are you buying under a trust? Is it just yourself? Is it your partner as well? Can you buy with someone? And then you got things like, you know, people buying property in the SMSF and things like that. So there's so many ways that we can get there. But my main point that I say to people is like, firstly, you just got to get started. And what I find so, I scratch my head even now, is that people who've never bought property will go, I just want to buy my own home, which I get. But what I don't get is that one property is going to cost me $1.5 to $2 million. Would you go to a lake and say, I'm going to go straight in, dive head first, not knowing how deep the water is? No, you're not. You'd go, let me test out if I even want this. And so one of the things I talk about is rent vesting is going, okay, firstly, rent in an area you think you might want to live in, because chances are you might not like it. And then the other part to it is, if I can take on debt for $2 million, you're now stuck. Because if the market pulls back 10%, you're screwed. But if I can buy a property for 500, 600K, which is still possible, and the market goes down by 10%, if my rental situation is in a good spot, I can hold that. Mm. And real estate here is just a game of who can hold the property for as long as possible through multiple cycles, and you'll get the baseline foundation done. Mm. And obviously with you guys, like you talk about development, I talk about how do you get the foundation right? Once you got the foundation, then it's going, I can take the acceleration approach, which is development, renovate, flip, and then get into other assets. That's how I sort of approach it.
Yeah, you're right. Like, the problem is people go out and buy, like what we said earlier, what our parents have now, and be a slave to that mortgage. And then where do you go from there? Like you said, if you're stuck in a sense, and you got this beautiful house, but to then go, you know, start investing, like we said, you're going to tap out on equity, or you're going to tap out on serviceability. And it's really hard to build a portfolio, especially in the capital cities, like you mentioned. So I think, yeah, your philosophy aligns of kind of, you know, what we recommend for people as well when it comes to not just having the pretty things and that delayed gratification, because it's, you can get there so much quicker if you give yourself that margin to then keep building. So
yeah, one of the best pieces of advice my dad gave me, actually, he goes, if you want to buy your place, you can, but that's all you'll buy. And I said, what does that mean? He goes, because as soon as you buy that first place, and let's say it's 800K at the time, it was, you could get a house. He goes, if you buy the $800,000 home, you'll never buy anything after that. And obviously he didn't have understanding of like different structures and different ways to get around it. But that's effectively the truth, where if you buy a place for 1.5 mil, your borrowing capacity is gone. Like there is no other option. And now you've just got to wait. Maybe it's 5-6 years until you get back into the market. So one of the best advice points that I've got is if you're going to go out there and you want to buy a $5 million house or a $2 million house, work backwards and say, can I actually get there or am I going to settle? And life's too short to settle. So I'm in the game of and rather than or. I think there's a world where you can live your best life. You can still get educated. You can still go and buy and invest in properties, invest in other assets and enjoy what you're doing. But I think that the way that we get there is a bit different and what we prioritize.
So a couple things. One is how do people get there, right? And I'll give you some scenarios because I know that you mentioned, oh, you can buy a house for $500,000-$600,000. And I know there'll be people watching and there'll be people in the comments that'll be like, you show me where you could buy a house for $500,000. So one is, where are people buying? Where do you see a lot of your clients now buying and having some successes outside of what we know as the Gold Coast and where we want to be, or, you know, in the inner suburbs of Sydney and the inner suburbs of Melbourne and these types of places? Because the reality is majority of people live within a 5 kilometer radius and that is what they know. Mm-hmm. Like even myself, I don't invest in Brisbane. I don't invest in Sydney. I invest in the Gold Coast, right? Because I know that market really well. And majority of people will be the same. They'll know that 5 kilometer radius. And if they can't get a $500,000 in that five kilometer radius, it's like, no, I can't. So a couple things. One is, where can people go and find these types of deals like you did, right? And we've had a couple other people that on that we've banked the podcast. We haven't released those yet. And they're doing the exact same thing. This is how they're creating their. One guy came in and said to us, I've literally just bought an apartment on the way here for $100,000. And I'm in my mind, right? As soon as he says that, the stigma is I'm picturing what this thing looks like and where it is. I'm just like, right? But the reality is it's probably not bad. It's just in an area that might be a growth area or could be a growth area. So where are people buying? Or you don't have to give the exact suburbs. What are some of the areas that if someone's listening to this going, I can only afford a $500,000 property right now because I got a 10% deposit. I got 50 grand plus another 5 grand for closing costs, you know, and bits and pieces, whatever it is. And that's that. And then let's go a little bit more into a roadmap of those people. Let's go first the property side, and then I'll ask you another question.
Well, think about it this way. If you and most people operate like this, as you said, is 5 to 10 kilometers, that's what I know, that's what I'm going to stick to. It's like going in and saying tomorrow you're only going to do things or act on information you know. That's how we operate. Yeah. But you listen to podcasts, you go, you know, read books, talk to people, and you try and expand that knowledge. And what you realize is through networks, you're like, oh, actually, I didn't even know that existed. Similar to what you guys are doing. It's, you know, people don't know what you guys do. They're never going to know that. So you don't know what you don't know. And now it's like, oh, I just want to be in the room with those same people. And so now obviously podcasts like this help a lot because you start opening up your mind for the people that listen. And so one of the things that we do is go, okay, well, you may not know about this area, but we do all the research here, which is why if you go and outsource something like that, now I'm not just working with 10 suburbs. I work with 10,000 suburbs. And chances are it's all a numbers game. So there's going to be some that are popping off when others aren't. And so what you want to do is, or at least how I've done it, is as part of your portfolio, what you ideally want is one in each state. So you don't have things like land tax issues as much. And then you have each market is going to go up at some point and other ones will go down. But at any point, you've got some property that's giving you some sort of equity. So it's like you're diversifying it and it's almost like the ETF of investing in property.
I think that's a very good strategy. And that's the strategy I've used in my life around business. I'm involved in different businesses, in different industries that have no relation to each other. And over the last 15 years, there's been times where one is doing really well and the other one not so well, and then vice versa. And I think that's a great piece of advice, especially around the real estate as well. I haven't done that myself, but it makes a lot of sense to spread that risk, because when one's going up, the other one might be coming down. So obviously you have a buyer's agency, right? So it might sound like you're, you know, pissing in your own pocket, call it, which is not the case, right? Because we're not here trying to say you have to go to search property and that's the only, you know, buyer's agency to use in the country, and they're the best, and I'm sure you guys are amazing. But even in my learnings recently, right, interviewing a lot of different types of buyer's agents, I've never used a buyer's agent before. Don't ask me why. Just, it's just an industry that over the last little while has really grown and is actually a thing. Before, a buyer's agent was just like one dude, you know what I mean, that you call and it's just, that's it. Now you guys, like, you have 80 staff in this business now. So how does a buyer's agent work? So if I'm that person and I've got 500, I've seen in my mortgage broker, I can service 500 grand. How does it work when we call search, when they call search property and they're just like, please guide me?
Yeah. Right? We effectively start with what that end goal looks like. What's the strategy? Bring it out and go, okay, if you have interest in building it through residential property, this is one way we could do it. And I think a lot of people go, okay, well, if I've got this one page document, I've got the roadmap, I don't need you. The other thing you mentioned was, oh, you know, where are you buying? What's the suburbs? And now it's like, there's so many tools out there that there's probably too much information. And a lot of people know the YouTube algorithm. So they're like, oh, I'm just going to talk about best areas to buy. And they never often turn into customers because they're just looking for the cheapest option to get to that point. But what you realize is when you get into these areas, you might even think, okay, this is the best area. All the numbers make sense. Now you've gone from, I'm at school doing education on paper. Now I go into the real world. And when you go into the real world, they're not going to care that you think that this is the best price that I can pay, because the real estate agent is going to go, cool, man, I've got like four other buyers, so I don't really give a shit. And so the reality of a lot of the, you know, education translating into the real world, talking to agents, negotiating, building those relationships, you've got to compare a buyer's agent who's probably doing 10 to 15 deals every couple of months with the same agent. So they know, oh, it's Ravi calling. Oh, cool. Yeah. How's that property? Okay, great, great, great. Hey, we've actually got something coming up. So you get a lot of access to off-market deals versus Tom calls some random dude. Hey, I want to buy a property. Cool. Join the line. Yeah. And he has no idea if you're going to be serious. He doesn't know if you're a competitor. He doesn't even know that you've got finance. Mm-hmm. But when they come to search property, it'll be like, oh, cool. I'll know that their buyers are going to buy because they're all vetted. Mm-hmm. And they've got people there that are going to hold their hand because this buyer is going to get nervous at some point. They're going to call me and irritate me. I don't want that. Yeah. So if they can deal with someone else, that's how buyer's agents have become so popular, especially because now you've got that nationwide approach. But now with anything, if you get too many people come into the system and the barriers are low, you get a lot of bad actors in the space. And that's what I think a lot of people are going to realize over the next 5 to 10 years is, oh, I bought a property because this bloke told me to, or this two-man band told me to, and now what? I'm screwed. And it's because they were in it for the quick run.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that around.
Oh, there's so much of that around. So much of that, especially in the space that you guys are in, you know?
Yeah, it's come across pretty quickly. All, like you said, all the buyer's agency, and everyone wants to be a buyer's agent all of a sudden. So can I ask quickly, with the areas you're looking into, what sort of DD and what risks are you finding in different areas? Like you got mining resource up north and in Hunter Valley, what areas do you head towards and don't? Are there any hard rules?
Yeah, definitely. We've got like a full-blown team there doing the DD on every deal, every location. And what we look at is at a very high level, because it'll get pretty boring if we go into the numbers and all that, is we're looking at, is it a diversified economy? Or is it just, hey, there's a mining town and it's probably going to boom for the next couple of years and I can make a lot of money? We don't want that. I want a set and forget option. Mm-hmm. Then we're looking at, okay, if what's the relative affordability here? And if the prices do go up by 20, 30, 40%, how many more buyers, how many more sellers do we have? How much infrastructure spent is being done by the government? Is it an actual area that's in the government's eye line, or is it not? Is it just something you picked up thinking that the numbers make sense? And then you've got to look at, okay, what's the incoming demand here and incoming supply? So for you guys, you would know it's, you know, looking at what sort of approvals are in the space, what's in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. And if you go, okay, if there's 50,000 homes coming and I've only got 10,000 more people wanting to move here, it's not going to look like a very good investment. And so a lot of these areas have already got lower levels of supply. And so what we're looking for as part of that process is going, okay, we're meeting up all those metrics and everything needs to make sense. But I always say this as well, is you can try and find the perfect location, the perfect timing, the perfect property, and you're probably going to miss out on 900 really good properties that give you what you need. So what you've got to really go at is, how do I get to as close as possible to 100% and then try my best to negotiate at the price I want? Because that's still going to get me what I want moving forward versus I'm just going to find this perfect one, the perfect opportunity, which is similar in business. You're never going to find the perfect product that's going to work on all fronts. And one thing that was, I picked up, it was, I don't know where I read it, but it was like, if it's the perfect opportunity, chances are it's already passed because it was not an opportunity anymore, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's always a deal of a lifetime everywhere. About two or three of Shannon and I's best deals have actually been at the peak of a market where everyone's like exiting, and now we're looking and deals are still coming up, and it's, you know, we look at it and its own merit, and you know, we've been able to negotiate incredible terms. So it's always just looking, you know, everywhere. But then obviously being countercyclical, you know, obviously Perth's had its time in the sun. A lot of buyer's agents were smashing that, and everyone seems to be going up to Townsville and going hard really there now. Now I know Eric's called it, and I know Shannon and I've had big discussions around Melbourne. You look at Melbourne's population, it's going to, you know, at some point in the next kind of 20, 30 years, I think, overtake Sydney from a population growth. Yeah. So I look at that, and you look at the difference between Sydney and Melbourne, it's typically, you know, it's at 150,000 or something below Sydney, or 200,000, and now the gaps widen so much. And I look at Melbourne, and yes, it's got some land tax issues, but when you actually dig deeper, it's not horrific. Like it's worse than the rest of the country, but I look at Melbourne at the moment and go, there's a gap that's going to close. And I know Melbourne has definitely started running, and I know a lot of buyer's agents are heading in that space at the moment. Is that an area that you're looking at, or do you see, you know, some good upside there?
Yeah, we try and avoid anything sort of within an hour of the capital city, to be honest. And that's purely because we want that balance between the yield as well as the growth. Yeah. But also, when you are in an area like that, when you're closer to capital cities, that's where you have, you know, high density population as well. And what happens is the government comes out and they can change their mind, and they change it sometimes in your favor when zoning gets changed, and sometimes it's not in your favor. Where if you think, okay, this area, there's no units here, I'm going to buy a house or, you know, whatever, and then the rules change and the zoning changes, sometimes you can be benefiting from that. But when it comes to property investing, it's like, you know, law of probability, obviously. So for me, I go, okay, well, instead of knowing, and we buy in Victoria, by the way, and we're buying a lot more now, is I go, okay, what's an hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 hours from here that is actually just a smaller version of that? And the best way to understand it is, and I was trying to explain it to people, was, you know, if I think Sydney was going to grow, I actually would have got better numbers and returns in Newcastle because it was like, it benefits from there, and everything's smaller. So like there's less population, but there's less supply, and I can benefit more from those things. And especially now that like you can live anywhere you like, and if you're having to come into work once a week, you can travel the 1.5 hours or whatever. And so that's how I approach it. So if I'm looking at, can I buy something for 400K, but they could release a bunch of land and there's more properties and it's going to stagnate my growth? Or can I go 2 hours further out and I can buy something for about 400, 500, 550, and I've got a bit more in terms of the rental yield as well? That gives me all of, you know, that ticks me my boxes because that's how I did it.
Yeah. What are you looking for a rental yield? Obviously, resi, you know, a lot of the gross yields are pretty horrific.
Yeah.
But you start adding in all the other costs and maintenance, the net yield's not great, which is where the capital cities tend to lose, right? So in building that portfolio, yes, you might not get the capital growth as much, but the capital growth in these areas that are short commute, like you say, an hour, hour and a half, are still going to be solid, but you're going to get that yield. So what are you looking for, a particular number in that yield?
Yeah, we try and like, and it's changed over the years because it used to be like anything under 6.5 is shit. Then it became 5.5. Now we're sort of at that late fours is like our baseline of what we want. But then you've got to match it up with, is it just because there's a tenant in there that, you know, is paying below the market rent? And that's where the due diligence really comes in, is to find out what's the true value here when it comes to rentals, and going, okay, there might be an opportunity to get a good deal because we take a hit on the cash flow for the first 6 months, but realistically in 6 months we've got a market where that rent isn't what it's supposed to be, and so now that's where we can pick up some undervalued assets.
I think a lot of people have also dived right into negatively gearing as the solution and the holy grail, and obviously yeah, the tax setup in Australia is, you know, there's some obviously some good kickbacks there. But what's your thoughts on negative gearing as a strategy?
Firstly, you should probably not listen to your accountant about where to buy the property. They should just help you minimize taxes, right? That's the first thing. Their job when you employ them is to minimize taxes, right? And they're going to help you with a bunch of other things. And if you get the right one, they're helping you structure the business the right way as well. A property strategist shouldn't give you accounting advice, same thing. But the way I see it is you're not buying property to reduce your taxes. And if you are, you're doing it wrong. What you're doing is I'm buying property to grow my wealth. And I've always been of the firm belief that if I have to pay an extra 47 cents, but I still get to keep 53 cents, I'm taking that deal every day of the week. And what a lot of people do is go, oh, actually, I don't want to make that extra dollar because I have to pay taxes. You're like, just make more because you can always make more. You can only save 100% of your income. And that's how you get further ahead. That's how I think about it.
So you're saying the negative gearing era is over.
Yeah, I don't think it ever began, but I wasn't part of it.
Yeah,
certainly pushed for a long time.
It's that time of year again at Unemployable, where we're opening up our Unemployable business coaching program. It's over a 12-month period, and with that, you get private one-on-one coaching, group coaching, as well as private and live events throughout the year. You can get private coaching with me, and not only me, but our panel of experts that we have put together. These panel of experts have been in our network and are the exact people that we use in our business successes. People from branding, sales, marketing, our lawyers, our accountants, everyone that has helped build our businesses, you have access to. If this sounds of interest, go to www.unemployable.com.au/coaching and register your interest to see if it's a fit for you and us. Hope to see you there.
You said a couple of things earlier when we were explaining how buyer's agents work. And you mentioned before anything, you said, we work out a strategy, right? And I think this is very important to talk about because most people don't have a strategy. They have a hope, right? They've got a goal to do something. They've got a wish, but they actually don't have a roadmap. And you mentioned roadmap and you mentioned strategy. And I want to get that very clear because with what you guys do, so if I were to come to you guys, a buyer's agent, right, specifically your company, and go, hey, I've got the 500 grand, but I also want to buy more. Do you literally sit there and strategize with them as well and go, okay, well, if this is what you're earning, without giving financial advice, because you're not a financial planner, of course, I'm not sure if you have financial planning in your business or not, but you can give them a bit of a roadmap in regards to, okay, we can help you get here. And these are the areas we're going to be looking at. And then from there, what I'd recommend is do this and go see this person and that person. And then within, you know, 12 months or 18 months, if you can hit that, we can then bring you back. Do you work with that? Do you work with them on?
That's exactly how it works. I think what we've taken is a step further, which is every 3 to 6 months after your purchase, we're doing strategy sessions regardless. There's no cost associated with that. And I think that's the part that keeps you accountable. So similar to if I go and hire a personal trainer, and I'm not in great shape, but if I go and get a personal trainer and they give me the workout plan, they give me the meal plan, and they go, we'll do the first workout together. I'll show you the machines and that's it. Okay, but I still need someone to hold my hand. I need someone to keep me accountable. So what happens is you pretty much, it's not going to work for you. But every 3 to 6 months, if we're catching up with you and saying, hey, by the way, like the mortgage broking arm has now done your numbers and this is how much equity you had, they're going, oh shit, I didn't know that. I thought like my property wasn't growing because they're not paying attention to it, right? It, similar to like in crypto, you're looking at your profile every day. In property, you're not. And they also have nuances with how you're going to value that property. So if you go every 3 to 6 months, we're looking at the valuations, we're looking at what can be done, you're more likely to get to your end goal. So my thing is I'm keeping myself accountable that you came to us to actually have more freedom and choice. You're not coming to us to buy one property. You're building a portfolio. So every 3 to 6 months, we've got to adjust and pivot. And sometimes people have kids that they didn't expect. Now it's like, okay, let's pivot the whole thing. And those are the sort of conversations that I think bring a lot more value rather than, oh, hey, come here and I'll find you a property. And that's pretty much what everyone's selling at the moment. But if they're a one or two person band, they just don't have the resources to be able to give you that support. And you're not going out there buying like groceries, you're buying property, which is like 400, 500, 600K, yeah. And you're taking on debt.
And that's why I want to be clear on that is that strategy side is very important. It's not like you go and buy a property through a real estate agent, right? There's zero strategy they're giving you other than the strategy of going, hey, we're going to go to auction and here's the strategy that we're going to use, or let's go in, I know, you know, let's go in with, you know, terms or, you know, shorter terms or a bigger deposit, this type of thing. But there's zero strategy around, you know, road mapping and what you can do and who you can meet to actually go and build that portfolio, whereas buyer's agent is. And the other thing is, you guys are really getting deals that no one else is getting access to, right? And that gives you a massive competitive advantage because of the work that you guys are doing in the background. So when you call Bob, the real estate agent that has the listing or an off-market property, they know, well, especially the agent, they know, like you said, you're going to close, right? They know you've done the due diligence already. Like, my buyer's ready to go. So they're not going to be wasting their time, because all Bob wants to do is sell that property and make his commission, right, in as less amount of settlement time as possible. And that's one other thing I really want people to understand. The reason why, if you were going to use a buyer's agent as well. So it's not just a buyer's agent is a person that's just going to hold your hand and buy the property and see you later. You know, there's a lot of hand holding, which is great to know. And I love that strategy that you used before. And it is a strategy, right, that you guys are using. Whereas when you're saying, think about an hour and a half outside of a capital city. Because the reality is this, as property prices go up like they are, the demographic of an area changes heavily. And I've seen this on the Gold Coast in the last 5 years since COVID, right? The type of people that are living here now, the type of cars that are on the road, the businesses that it's attracting, the restaurants, the cafes, it's changing. And the reason why it's changing is because there's people coming from external areas into the Gold Coast. But what happens is all the people that used to live on the Gold Coast can now not afford, a lot of them, to live on the Gold Coast, right? And all of a sudden they're going, I used to live in Mermaid. I used to live in Palm Beach. I can't afford that anymore. So where do they go? They go to Pimpama, which is a half an hour away. They might go to Logan, which is 45 minutes away. They might go, you know what? I'm going to move to Canungra, right? Which is an hour away, you know, over the mountain, because it's cheaper and they'll still commute. But again, you guys have the eyes on the Canungras and these areas before they're actually going, right? Which I think is a very, very unique strategy, especially for, I think the people that you're helping are more within, is your target market more those people that are in that kind of 500 grand to 800 grand, that range, right? If I'm not really coming to you saying, hey, I want to purchase my $10 million property on the beachfront, right?
No, definitely not. And we've always stuck to investment properties only. It used to be, we used to pick up properties for like 250, 300. Now it's like the baseline that we would work with is say 350 to 400. And that's purely because there's maintenance and there's other things that could pop up on properties that are less than that. And so we just don't touch those types of properties. And we're going, we have clients that are wanting to build a machine that's set and forget. So if they're buying the 100K or 150K properties in the areas at least we're looking at, you're not finding the ideal property that's going to give you peace of mind. So it's really 400 to 800 is probably the nice range.
Well, can I play devil's advocate for a little bit?
Of course.
Like, obviously, you know, do you look at, I look at a buyer's agent and go, oh, you're always going to tell me it's a good time to buy. And, you know, right now there's maybe wars happening and, you know, I'm scared about that. Or are you looking at, you know, recessions that may come? There's a property clock and 18 years is coming up and it might crash in a couple of years' time. One of the reasons we actually got coaching from Unemployable is because we're doing a lot of property events and everyone's just patting you on the back like, yeah, keep going, going to more debt. My property development's amazing. And there's people cooking the books left, right, and center. But then there's going to be another GFC, whatever it's the next one's called. Do you look at things like, where do you see Australia's landscape at the moment where it comes to the property clock? Are we in a recession? Like, do you think about those more kind of zooming out, looking at the bigger picture?
Oh, definitely.
Economics?
I think about it on three fronts because I've got a property business and I employ a lot of people. And then I've got my own personal portfolio and I've got a lot of debt. And then I'm helping people that are trusting us after watching me for years to go and put their money towards, you know, these things. So it's my job, it's my duty to go in and always be looking forward, because everyone's looking down and they're in the day to day, and I get to work on the business, but I get to look at those things and then, you know, obviously share that information. I'm not oblivious to the fact, and I've said it on the channel as well, I don't think property prices continue going up just in a straight line. It'd be silly. But that line going up straight to the right, or up to the right, is only because we have the currency losing its value down to the left or down to the right. And so as long as that number keeps going the other way, we've got hard assets going the other way, right? And so that's how I look at it, as a very macro landscape or view. When rates started going up in 2021, 2022, I said Sydney and Melbourne are probably not where you want to be, because prices will come down. And they did, for about 7 or 10%. Some areas went down by 12%. And so I'm not oblivious to the fact that we will see corrections along the way. And so that's why strategy and acquisition plans are so important, because we get some people that have been watching for a while and they'll go, man, I want to buy 5 properties now. I've just inherited money. Let's go. I've gone, cool, man. But my thing is that we want to test the waters first. I want to know if you even like having a tenant, because you might not.
Yeah. Dollar cost average on property.
That's it. And so I think having that emergency fund is big. Knowing what industries the employees are in, like the people that are coming to us, are they in something that's going to be sustainable long-term? Is it something that's quite risky? Are they running their own business? Have we structured that right? Have they spoken to an accountant? I think about those things a lot, probably a lot more than most people think about, just because I've got so much exposure in that entire industry. But I think there's going to be some sort of correction, but it's not now. You know, even though, and this is so important for us to know, is because we have our circle of friends, the voice that we have around us, and we think everyone must be thinking this way. I've got a couple of mates that I talk to, and we've got a WhatsApp chat, and it's like everyone's buying, everyone's investing in this, building that, and we're like, oh, everyone must be doing it. But as soon as you go to a family gathering or you hang out with people you don't really hang out with, they're doing the opposite.
Oh, they're scared shitless.
Exactly. So no crashes ever occur when people are depressed or people are down about, you know, sentiment. And sentiment's pretty low. It's starting to tick up a little bit, but it's still very low. And that's why I knew during, you know, the lockdowns and everything that was coming out, like, oh, you know, doomsday and this, that. I was like, man, it doesn't happen at that point. It's just market cycles and human psychology. It's when prices are up and you've got everyone bullish on it and everyone thinks nothing can fail. Do you feel like that when you talk to 5 people that aren't in your circle? No. And so that to me is like my litmus test. And you can see it in your YouTube comments. And I'm fortunate because I've got that, which is I can go through and see the comments and you see it. It's changed every single month. You know, we have trends around this now. How many negative comments are we getting? How much, you know, how many likes versus dislikes? And you can see that, okay, the tide is shifting, but it's not where people think it is. So people often go, I can rationalize another 10% growth, but 30%? No. Well, markets aren't rational. Like, they don't operate on based on your emotions. And so the market doesn't care about you and I and what our feelings are.
Go ahead.
Finish one for a sec. I just want to loop back to strategy for a second and break it right down really simple. So if you had, say, a young couple come to you, late 20s, hope you've got a good calculator in your head. no kids yet. And their plan was to get to, say, 70, 80K a year passive to replace an average wage because they're wanting to buy more property or they wanted to have children later. What does that journey look like? How many properties do they have to buy? How long would it take? And what sort of deposit would they need to get there?
So assuming they use, like, say, a 10% deposit on a property that you purchase for, say, 500-600K, it's probably negative by about 5-7K a year, right, to hold that property. So after about year 3, it's going to turn positive. So that's a combination of rates coming down slightly, but your rent's increasing. So you've got a property that's now neutral cash flow in 3 years' time. And then every year after that, on average, you should probably see that property give you about five to six K in terms of rental, right? So if you go, okay, that one property in 3 years' time is neutral, but in 5 to 10 years' time is now giving me, you know, anywhere between $10,000 and $20,000, I probably need 4 of those in that cycle. So I've got to hold 4 properties for about 7 to 10 years to be able to get me to $80,000. That's very, you know, back of napkin sort of numbers. But that's how I would approach it. Yeah.
Yeah. The only way to expedite that would be get 2 at the front and start that journey a little bit quicker. So come with a bit more deposit.
Correct. And then you got to go, okay, well, if you are going to, do you think your income's going to improve? If it is, what does that look like? Are we going to buy under personal names? Are we going under trust structures? Like, how are we going to do it? And then are you building this just for yourself, like you and your partner, or is this like generational wealth? Because if it's generational wealth, then maybe they start thinking about, oh, well, actually, I've got money in my super and I can purchase those properties that are going to be for my kids. Like, there's so many ways around it.
Mm. Oh, very good. Thanks.
What are the common mistakes that you're seeing people making when they're looking at entering into specifically the property market on a leverage basis? What are the financial mistakes they're doing? Are they, you know, is it the credit card debt? Is it like, what are some pointers you can give people that they can just adjust a little bit and all of a sudden their serviceability can be that much better? Because like you said before, you've got two things, right? You've got reduce your expenses or increase your income, right? Here we're all about, I'm in the mindset all the time of increase your income, right? If you're decreasing your expenses, you're decreasing a lifestyle, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the harder things to do, right? Because people don't want to give away the Uber Eats and the new clothes and, you know, the car and the rest of it. And I'm always just like, and a mate of mine, you know, good friend of mine always said, he goes, man, don't worry about saving money. Don't worry. Just go make more. Go make more. Find ways to make more, right? And this is what I love to do. And this is, you know, what Unemployable is all about. But for the people that are in the headspace going, I can't make more right now. I'm already working two full-time jobs. I've got two kids. Easy for you to say, asshole, you don't know my position, right? How can we help those people? What are some tips we can give them to get them so they can actually sit down in front of a mortgage broker and go, you know what? You're actually not too far off. You just got to adjust a few things.
Yeah, I think you nailed it there where you mentioned the mortgage broker. There's still so many people that think this is the bank that I bank with. That's who I go to get my loans as well. And they only have one option. Whereas a mortgage broker gives you all those options and they can work out and strategize, hey, actually you've got business income, which is treated differently at these three lenders. So I should probably go for this lender. Yeah. The same thing goes for when people are looking for the lowest interest rate. So you're looking to get financed to get it's a solution to the problem. What's the problem? On a purchase property. Your problem isn't, hey, the interest rate is high, the interest rate is low. That's a secondary problem or secondary factor that you consider. So you go, okay, my main goal is I want to buy a property. All right, awesome. You can buy a property with these five lenders because you've got the borrowing capacity. Awesome. What are the pros and cons? Well, here's three options that work well for you. Based on your income and what you want to do moving forward, because we know how they, you know, look at servicing, you're only going to be able to go with these two lenders. Then you think about the interest rate. Because at the end of the day, like when you can't buy a property versus you buying a property with a 1% or 2% interest rate that's higher, you could always refinance that later, or you can, you know, change it around. So that's the first thing that I would look at, is talk to someone who lives and breathes that sort of stuff. And then when it comes to like personal expenses, your credit cards and things like that, I understand that, you know, some people have like $1,000 on it and they're like, oh, it doesn't matter, I pay it off and this and that. A mortgage broker doesn't look at it that way. They say, well, your credit card limit is $25,000. Which means tomorrow, if you wanted to use the 25K, you could. And I find it very interesting that, you know, we've got a system where if you literally go into the bank and say, I want to take on debt, okay, what's the debt for? And they say, okay, well, I want to buy some stuff. Like, you know, just, I want to go out and have a good night at the nightclubs. Cool. Credit card.
Here's a credit card.
Yeah. And it's the highest interest rate. I want to do this and that. Oh, it's personal loan. Cool. Fairly high as well. I want to buy property. Oh, come in. I'll try and get you the best rate. The other part to it as well is, you know, bad debt, good debt. We've all sort of learned about that. But when we think about, you know, bad debt and good debt, we've got to think about the assets that we're purchasing. And Robert Kiyosaki went viral for a minute there where he was like, oh, you know, your house is not an asset because it doesn't produce an income. The one part that I would add is like an asterisk to that is, well, it provides you equity to be able to get you X, Y, and Z. And probably you pay no tax on capital gains taxes, right? Or very little, depending on when you sell. And so if people are looking to go, oh, I'm getting started, how do I not let go of my lifestyle as well as still go out there and live the life I want to live, and I'm working two full-time jobs, they need to Google Scott Galloway and they need to understand one major thing. And it's unfortunate, but it's the truth. It depends on what industry you're in and it depends in which country you're in. So if I work 50 hours a week in a high leverage industry, I'm making a lot more than someone who's working in a lower leverage industry. For example, I think people that own restaurants outwork me day and night. They will outwork me. But the amount that they get as a reward is significantly different to what I would get because I'm in a boring business that's, you know, finance, high leverage. So I think that if people are out there and they're working to the bone and they've got no other options, it's now going, cool, I need to now take a macro view of this and say, am I in the right industry? And why am I in this industry? Because a lot of people do jobs because of the status it gives them. I can say I do this, I can say I do that. But how many people could work at a specific place or a different location and they could make a lot more and their expenses would be lower naturally?
I'll give you an example. My mom, right? Worked at a factory for years, right? 15, 20 years, whatever it was. Every day went there. It was a clothing manufacturing business. Now, that clothing manufacturing business, it was in Canada. Obviously, writing's on the wall. Not many clothing manufacturing businesses in the Western world anymore. They decide to shift and go to Mexico, right? So it's like, okay, everyone, here you go. Here's a couple of vouchers. Thanks for working for us. And we're off to Mexico, right? Everyone that's working in that factory is like, oh my God, my life, like, what am I going to do now? I'm not educated. This is what I've done for 15 to 20 years. I've never made a resume. What do I do? Out of your comfort zone, right? Mindset shift, like, holy shit, fight or flight, right? It's fight or flight now. Here we go. She then does, you know, her CV and goes to, you know, career fairs and bits and pieces. And this is, you know, that's a construction worker at the time. They have a mortgage, they're raising two kids, trying to make ends meet, right? Scarcity mindset, and it's just like, shit. She then gets a job at another factory, getting paid twice the amount, right? And she's been there ever since, and she just retired from there. But it goes to show you, I can guarantee you, if that place didn't shut down and move to Mexico, she would have retired there, not thinking, right? Not giving her any other option. And there's so many people, like what Shannon said before, that create this box for themselves, this glass ceiling, this glass box that they sit in, and they don't think there's anything else.
Yeah, I was one of them. They're cleaning carpets for 15
same thing,
years,
right? You know? Same thing. If you don't go to those real estate seminars, you don't surround yourself with some other people, right? And get that confidence of trying to break through that box. Carson today is cleaning carpets. Shannon today will still be working for the excavation company, right? That is the reality, right? And what questions would you ask someone that is in that scenario right now? Because it's easy for us to come on here and go, yeah, but just do it. Just do it. It's all good. It will always work out, right? Que sera, sera, all this type of thing. But what are the mindset shifts people need to have? Like my mom at that time had no choice. It's like, here's your paper, sayonara. It wasn't her choice. What we're trying to do is make people think about it so it can be their choice, right? Because no one likes to, right, be made redundant or, you know, not have a job to then be in a fight or flight scarce mindset. And usually you're not going to make the right decision because you're from a scarce mindset, not an abundant mindset. What are some of the things, what are some of the pointers that you can give, and any of you guys as well, Shannon, Carson, chime in here, because we've all been in that situation, right? Like I was in the situation going, I've got a good job. I'm good. I live at home. I get my underwears ironed. I've never cooked. I don't know how to do laundry. Man, I'm the golden child, right? And I left to come to a country I've never been before, right? Why? Because my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, had the confidence to do so. If it wasn't for her, I would probably be back home doing similar things that I was doing before, not being on a podcast, like all these things, right? So how can we help people other than listen to podcasts? Yeah. Read books. Okay. How do you take action? How can you get someone to go, you know what? I'm fed up. I'm actually going to do something about this, right? And I want that car I've always wanted. I want that holiday I've always wanted. I want that white picket fence if that's what you want around your property.
I'd say two things and then you guys can jump in as well. One of the first things I'll do is I would audit for an entire week who I speak to, what I listen to, and what I consume. Because I guarantee you it's probably not in the work that you're avoiding. Oh, the work that you are doing, it's probably the work that you're avoiding. And you're filling it in with all this other rubbish. So I'd be auditing myself first up and be I guess it would be pretty savage, but you'd get rid of a lot of those people.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we've all done it. There's people around in our circles that we used to talk to, don't talk to anymore. That's the first thing I'll do. And the next thing I'll do is figure out why. Like, do you just want to get rich because you want to be rich? Do you want to buy a car because you want to look good? Get deeper into it and just keep asking why. And I think you'll get to the fundamental reason as to why you want to do it. Mm-hmm. For me, like, I don't have aspirations to drive, you know, Lamborghinis and, you know, this and that. Like, I don't care about that stuff. I also am like a real basic bitch when it comes to food. So I have no interest in trying different restaurants and like this and it's uncooked and this and that. Like, I don't care about that. For me, at the core of it was that my dad used to work all the time. He had two jobs. Mum brought us up. And I remember that my relationship with dad was very different to mum. It was like, I grew up with mum and like I had that open relationship with her. Whereas with dad, it was like, oh, he's at home. He took a day off. That's freaking weird. And I didn't have that relationship. Now we've obviously worked on a lot, but I've always thought, hey, I want to be that guy that rocked up and just, you know, turned up to those school events, even if I didn't want to. And it was like, just turning up meant a lot more for me than... And that's why, like, for me moving forward, that's what I want to do for my kids. And so one of those things was, hey, I could have a business and I could go and help people and I can go and invest in things. So my why was very important. But as part of that, like, I give away a lot, you know, a lot of money on the table is left. And I, you know, I'm fortunate. I have my brother work with me. My wife runs the mortgage broking company. Her brother works in the company. And then I want to get my parents out of debt and have them live their best life. Because I don't have aspirations to own all of these, you know, big yachts and super yachts and things like that, I'm fortunate I make a lot of money, which is great. As soon as I take care of myself and my future family, I'm going, okay, I want to help those guys get their dream homes and things. And I think because I have that mindset, it allows me to make so much more money because my why is bigger than me. It's going, I want to help these guys, you know, my best mates. I want to help you rather than I just want to be there at the top of the hill and be like, yeah, F you, you know, you guys didn't make it. I made it. I just don't operate like that. So I think once people figure out their why, they're going to go, shit, I'm going to take action and I'm going to go all out because that's what, you know, that was the fire within me. I don't know what you guys think.
I think for myself, I'd pretty much just echo what you said. Like, I think it's finding out what your why is, what your drive is, and then your circle. Like, if you close your eyes and picture your five closest friends and people, they'll typically have the same amount of money. They've got the same amount of kind of aspirations and bits and pieces. And if you want something different, you've got to surround yourself with the people that have got those results or at least heading in that direction. Like, I was in Byron Bay for a while and I wanted to learn how to be a better surfer. I wasn't, there was a couple of mates of mine that were in the same boat. I was just trying to go to the guys that were good surfers and just trying to, they'll naturally just pull you along. It's just like hanging around guys like Eric and Adam, like they think bigger. Like, I wasn't even thinking about inflation, you know, and what that was doing to my dollar. I was having a little, you know, bit of money to the side just to feel safe. And then knowing that it's going backwards by 7-10% or whatever it is each year, like, it's just thinking about things, you know, hanging around people that are got the results that you want at the end of the day. So I had, you know, when I was cleaning carpets, I was had to put food on the table for the family, and I was too scared to try something different because I just, you know, I stopped playing footy because I knew if I was injured there was no money, and I wanted to play footy, and I was just like, I can't take that risk for our family. I was making my 45 to 50 grand a year at that point, and I was just too scared. So for 10 years I just grinded away, and that was running my own business, taking the risk. Like, I could have actually worked for someone else and made more than that, but I was just, it was what I knew, and I was like I've got to find something else. And that's when I started doing the reliable education. Maybe I can do the selling on Amazon, maybe I do property. I mean, I joined Amway for a little while. I was like, I've got to find something like to get ahead, and property's been that vehicle for us. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, oh, if you got 100 grand, where would you invest it? I like property, and I went into property development because I had $0 and I heard someone doing no money down deals. And I know that if you find the right development site, the money will be there. And, you know, I surrounded myself around people that were doing it. And I was just like, and that's kind of what lifted us kind of out of that scenario that we had, because that circumstance that I was in, I wasn't saving any money and there was no scope to save. So I would need to get the side hustle, or I needed to go get educated and do something different. So thankfully that's what we did.
Shannon?
I'm not sure if I have a lot of wise words there. I've just, probably my upbringing, I was come from an area where we probably lived a bit rougher. So I've always had that push to not go back there. Yeah. I've always wanted to, I guess it's a fear of looking ahead and not being where I want to be. And as you get older and you look a bit deeper and you look at inflation and taxes and your super, where you land at the end, what are you going to be able to do with that? And you're not going to be able to do much. So like we said before, you have to have a side hustle. You have to do something if you want to live a comfortable life. Otherwise,
yeah,
you're going to get to the end of it and it's not going to be very comfortable. Your super is not going to carry you through a retirement anymore.
I agree.
Robbie, I know we've got to wrap up now, mate, but just quickly, you mentioned super, Shan. Investing inside your superannuation, obviously you can get tapped out of your serviceability. If you've got a decent amount in your super, that's an option for people. But now we've got these unrealized gains with superannuation. Just keen to get your thoughts on that and, you know, and investing inside a super.
Yeah, well, the super tax, I'm not sure who came up with that one. But I think there's a bigger issue at play because a lot of people would have seen that. I made videos about it as well. And they said, the comments were like, oh, well, who's got $3 million in their super? I'm like, yeah, but this is the gateway. Like, this is a sign of things that could potentially come because they can change the rules. And, you know, if they tax you on $3 million, what happens if it's $2 million? What are you going to do? You don't take a stand. You're not going to know where's the limit. They might go, okay, capital gains, maybe it's exempt. Now it's in play for your own occupier house. So I'm not a fan of that. And I think, you know, when you look at tax law and how it should work, it makes no sense because if you own a home and it goes up and how are you supposed to like pay it? It doesn't make any sense. So I'm not a fan of that one.
Completely contradictory to the purpose of it.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Superannuation tax should not go any higher than what it is. It's ridiculous.
But like you said before, though, is in the comments, we talk about this as well, right? And it's like, yeah, but whoever has $3 million in super can afford it. Like, this is the mindset. This is the root of the problem, right? Mm. The root of the problem is the mindset, like what we were talking about before, and how to change that mindset. Like, I see it in the comments all the time. Easy for you to say, you bought 20 years ago. That was cheap. Mm. Oh, you're a baby boomer. Oh, pff. Your house was free, basically. You bought your house for 50 grand. You know what I mean? 50 grand, I can't even buy a new car. This is the mindset, right? There's an invisible line, right? And you can either live below the line or you live above the line. And you know, you're accountable, you take risks, you educate yourself, or you live below the line and you live in a world of blame and hate and victim mentality, right? You can't be on the line. You're either one or the other. And what people need to decide is which side of the line they are now and which side of the line they want to be on. And if you're on the victim side and you want to stay there, right? Shut up. That's why I say, shut up, right? Don't even go into the comments, right? And put that negative energy, that bullshit into other people's minds in scarcity, right? But if you want to be below the line and you want to come above the line, let's do it, right? This is what we're doing, right? Like, we're not getting paid to sit here on the Unemployable podcast. You're not getting paid to sit there on your YouTube channel, right? Personal Finance with Ravi Sharma. You're doing it because you want to educate people. The more you educate people, you can then help them. Once you help them, there's then a monetary reward for you, but only if you're getting your point across, right? So we're not just doing this, right, to become famous and feel good about ourselves, right? Like, we're literally doing this to help people go from that negative scarcity mindset of not knowing, right? That person that is literally has his earbuds in, listening to fucking Eminem, cleaning carpets, right? Right? Like, right? Not sure if he was listening to Eminem or not, but like, he's now talking about deals to me off camera that I'm now thinking, like, these guys are going to another level than I'm at, right? And I'm like, what does that tell me? I'm like, I need in on this. Like, set up a desk for me at your office because I want to start spending some time with you guys there. That's what it inspires me, right? And I'm already above the line. So you keep going. But there's always times where you get below the line at times and scarce mentality comes in, right? Like, you put on the news and all of a sudden, you know, there's bombings happening and they're talking about this is World War III, and you put on CNN and you see, right? One thing, do not watch the news. Mm-hmm. My dad watches the news every freaking day. and we joke about it. We call him Anderson Cooper, right? Like literally Anderson Cooper was a guy that used to be on CNN. So we joke around about it, but it's a habit for him, right? He loves it. He watches it. But I'm using this as an example, right? Don't watch the news. There's nothing good that comes out of the news. It's just, it's depressing shit. Watch things that uplift you, you know? Write a plan. Sit down and write what you actually want and put dollar values beside it. So you can actually see, it's actually not $1 million that I need. It's only an extra $100,000, right? Or it is $1 million, or shit, it's $10 million. I got to pull my finger out and start thinking about some good strategies and start surrounding myself and listening to things and taking action, because that's, you know, I once had a guy said, I want a $1 billion company. But do you know what a $1 billion company actually takes, man? Like, why is it $1 billion, right? Work backwards, right? So, and know who you are, know who you're not. I love collaboration. I love doing deals with people. Like when a deal comes across my table, the first thing I think about, who can I get involved? I don't think about, I want it all for myself. I'm not interested. I'm interested, like you, in sharing wealth. I don't want to be the only guy on the boat while everyone, all my friends are working 9 to 5. I want all my friends, I want my family to come on the boat with me, right? And this is the mindset that we got to get more and more people in, especially in this country, right? US is a little bit different. North America, you know, you've got good things. They're high-fiving you, right? They're encouraging you. Here, just shh, it's like a shoot, like a negative energy sucking you down. Look at this wanker. Oh my God. Like, and you see it in the comments. You see it in the comments all the time, right? And it's unfortunate. And it's those people that are in the comments, right, that you want to help get above the line. You know, like you can see the pain in those comments. You've been in that pain. You've been in that pain. I've been in that pain. You've been in that pain, right? And we're moving ourselves out of that pain, right? And that's what inspires me so much. And I appreciate you as well coming on here, you know, and speaking for yourself and your journey and what you do with your YouTube channel, because we understand how hard it is to create like this content, right? Like to build a studio, like we're going to do this, let's build a studio, because that's what's going to make us accountable to show up every week, right? Because it's very easy to just do everything remotely and go, you know, I'm not going to do it this week. When you're here and you're paying the money and you do the fit out, you basically have no choice. It's putting your back against the wall, right? Now, before we finish up, I want to ask one more thing. And you do a bit of crypto stuff, and I want to get your take, because obviously this is a property predominantly podcast, but I want to get your take on Bitcoin specifically. I want to get your take on where you think it's going, whether you think it's good, whether you don't think it's good. I want to get your take on, we mentioned it a little bit, about the devaluing of the dollar, and that's why hard assets are going up. What's your take?
So I got into crypto first week of 2018, heard about it during Christmas, and I was like, everyone's making money, I should get involved. And as soon as I bought, it kept going lower, 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 lower for the next 6 months. And I'm like, I got scammed. And then I realized I was buying probably the wrong things. So I was just getting into altcoins and thinking, oh, Bitcoin's too expensive, I don't want to get into that. So I'll just continue buying altcoins and make money because everyone can 10X. And then a couple of years passed by. At the end of 2018, I turned my super into a self-managed super fund, and I went all into crypto because I was like, I'm never going to touch this money anyway, so I may as well just gamble anyway. And since then, I was sort of in the space for a while, and it's probably over the, you know, period of 2024, is when I started going deep into, okay, what am I actually putting money into? Because a lot of people, hand on heart, don't actually know what they're buying. And especially when it comes to like altcoins. And I started learning a bit more about Bitcoin, and I had one of those guys in my circle, you guys have Adam, and he's just like, man, Bitcoin's the best, bro. Bitcoin's the best. And I was like, yeah, I don't know about that. And then I started getting educated, books, listening to things. And I go, actually, this could be my biggest hedge against the traditional finance world. And so once I understood that, and it's actually quite easy for real estate guys to understand Bitcoin and vice versa, because you got scarcity, it's a hard asset, supply, demand, and whatnot. So once I realized that, I was like, all the other stuff is all fluff. Yes, they're going to be companies and they're probably having their dot-com moment But out of the thousands and thousands that exist, there's probably only like two or three that exist. And I'm not willing to take that bet. Mm. And if I can get comfortable with the returns I get in Bitcoin, well, then I win. And, you know, you see all these numbers that are crazy, like 500K, million, this and that. I think in this cycle, I don't think we get anywhere close to 200K USD. I think it's 150, 160, you call it a day. But I have no plans to sell my Bitcoin. I made that decision probably 8 or 9 months ago and I said, I'm never selling again. And then with all my altcoins, I'll sell everything. And I think we still have, you know, probably the next 6 months, at some point, you're going to see some of that retail money come back in. One of the cool things about YouTube is I've got videos from 2020 all the way through, you know, all of that time. So if I ever want to keep myself accountable, I always look back at those videos where I'm like, yeah, I'm making money. And then you realize it was getting, you know, smacked across the head. And the other thing that is interesting, and this is cool for you guys to know as well, is that I've got crypto videos from, you know, 2020, 2021, 2022. And when we see local tops in the market, those videos are the ones that are getting viewed in the last 60 minutes. And so as soon as I see there's a lot more people watching those videos, guys, it's time to get out. And I haven't seen that for a long time. And that's why I'm still of the opinion with consumer sentiment, how human psychology works is that we are nowhere near the top. And when I talk about the top, I talk about the entire crypto market.
Yeah.
Bitcoin's holding strong because I think now you've got a different audience that's now gravitating towards it. Mm. Whereas with altcoins, that's largely driven by people who want to go 5x, 10x. It's like going to the casino, and we haven't seen that enter. Once they enter and they do what they need to do, I think you still get your 2, 3, 10x, whatever. But I'm not sticking around for that.
Yeah. It's interesting because I got into it in 2021, and the day I bought it, same thing. It just went down for years. But I just held and held and held, and I bought more since. But I just look at statistics, right? And we do a Friday podcast, and these stats will be released in the Friday podcast, but I'll mention them again today. As of today, we're recording in June 2025. When you look at percentage of ownership in, I used USA, Canada, and Australia as an example, right? Shares, property, Bitcoin, right? And in the US, shares, 58% of the population own shares, 65% of the population own real estate, 14% of the population own any type of Bitcoin. When I say Bitcoin, I'm not talking about one Bitcoin. I'm just talking about a dollar of Bitcoin, 50 bucks of Bitcoin, just some Bitcoin. In Canada, 46% shares, 66% real estate, 10% Bitcoin, so even less. In Australia, it's 37% shares, 66% real estate, and 20% Bitcoin, right? So it's a lot higher actually, right? Double the amount of people percentage wise own Bitcoin in Australia. And I think this goes to show that, you know, specifically Australians are, one, are probably getting a little bit more educated, and two, are probably a bit fed up and going, shit, you know, I'm losing too much money here, right? And I gotta hedge against this devaluing of a fiat currency. And then I did another calculation and said, okay, how many people in the world own at least one Bitcoin, right? So 1.5 million people in the entire world, right? And the entire world is about 8.3 billion people or so. And there's a big portion of those people that obviously are in poverty. So they're never probably going to own Bitcoin, unfortunately. But that's 0.018% of the population that owns at least one Bitcoin. Mm. All I got to do is look at those stats and tell me that there's still plenty, in my opinion, right? For me, when I look at that, and that's what gives me more confidence, as well as the people that I surround myself with and get a better understanding, which is, excuse me. Yeah, it's interesting, right? Now, am I betting the house on it? No, right? But I think everybody should, you know, what everybody should do is go, one, what is your net worth? Because I don't think many people sit there and actually calculate their net worth. And I don't care if you're worth 50 bucks or you're worth 500 million. Everyone, in my opinion, and I even need to be doing a better job of it, need to be tracking their net worth from time to time. And I think that they should have an allocation percentage, right? I'm going, I want my net worth to be, and this is the background, right? This is having a plan. This is getting pen to paper and having a background of going, okay, I want 10% of my wealth held in this asset, 30% held in this asset, 70% held in this asset, and, you know, 10% held in hard cash in case of a rainy day, as an example, which is still an asset. But again, it's just getting pen to paper, because I think what that gives people is clarity, right? And what this is what we're trying to do is get clear and clear and clear. Adam has moved to Cyprus, right? He's got a fair bit of time on his hands now. The clarity that he's been getting and the value we've been getting off the back of his clarity and going to a lot of different events, we're on a chat. The stuff that I'm learning, right? Like, I didn't know anything about Bitcoin treasury companies, you know, 3, 4, 5 months ago. Now I'm just like, this is making sense, you know, like, and Mark, right? He's the one I was actually pushing, who's also on the pod, that's doing a lot of trading and going, you know, you need to start really allocating percentages of wealth, right? So, and these are the people that you're surrounding yourself with. So I'm getting feedback. These guys will be getting feedback. And then we get behind a mic and give our feedback to the rest of the people that want to listen. And then those people will give feedback to who they want to listen to. And this is how we can make change, right? Did you guys have any more questions, Carson, Shannon?
No, I've got one, but it'll spear off away from where we want to be. So I'll
we'll
leave
do a
that
part two. I'll come back then.
I'll leave that one alone at the moment.
It's been unbelievable to have you on. I can't wait to connect with you outside of the pod. Ravi, it's amazing that, like, I look at what you've done in the last 5 years, 2020, 100,000 subs, what you're doing. And now that's, you know, you're adding so much value to people. And I appreciate that. And I take my hat off to you, because hopefully in 5 years time, we can have 100,000 subs as well. And you know, create change. And every day we get DMs, we get emails, right? We get messages. Even these guys now, you know, are building so much momentum in that space. And people, like, we had someone on the pod yesterday going, like, the reason why we are here where we are today is because of Carson and seeing him on stage and his inspiration. And he didn't even know that. Like, this is what it's about here, right? So for those of you guys that are listening, for those of you guys that are watching, please like, subscribe, share, comment, let us know what we could do even better. We'll get more and more Ravis on. We're enjoying every minute of this and we'll continue to do so. And I guess one thing that you guys, there's so many nuggets of this in this podcast, but one thing is start getting pen to paper, create a little bit of a plan, get it out of your head, sit down with your business partner, sit down with your life partner. And if you don't have a partner, just sit down literally by yourself and start writing and documenting to actually see what kind of life you want to live. So that way you can then go, is it Bitcoin? Is it property? Whatever you need to do. The key is take action. And that first step to action is literally getting a blank paper, getting a pen and doing the work. And hopefully you guys got value out of this pod, and we will see you on the next one. We will just keep showing up. Thanks, guys.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.